Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on The Big Lead. I am Ryan Glasspiegel. We are joined by George Sedano, who has a number of roles at ESPN. His primary job is that he hosts Morning Drive on ESPN Radio in Los Angeles alongside Keyshawn Johnson and Elzie Granderson. He also appears on The Jump, the soon-to-be-defunct Sports Nation, highly questionable occasionally. He was a play-by-play announcer and sideline reporter at Summer League. So he's very versatile and he does a lot of different things. And I thought he'd be interesting to talk to. So George, you have just won the LeBron James lottery as a local radio host for the second time in your career. How does that feel?
Well, look, I think it feels great considering my contract's up in a year. I think the timing couldn't be any better. but with that said, I love it. And I think this time around, I think it'll be a little different in the sense of what's coming. So the first time around, and look, I think the reaction to LeBron going to Miami was different than LeBron coming to the Lakers. There was some surprise in some circles, but I think most people kind of got the feeling the Lakers were a real player here. And with Miami, it came out of the blue. They weren't a blue blood franchise. He was teaming up with Wade and Bosch. Everyone just saw all the negative when it came to that. And I basically spent the first year on radio defending him every single day. Now, I think there'll be some of that. But because I don't think the response will be as vitriolic as it was in Miami, I think, A, I'm better prepared for it, and B, I think we'll actually be able to focus on basketball a little more than maybe we did in Miami. But I think all of it is great because there's not a more polarizing person, I think, in sports than LeBron, especially when you consider the fact that he's a model citizen. I think that the guys that usually are in that category are guys who have some sort of off the field, off the court behavior that elicits that response, where he really doesn't have a ton of that. Occasionally there's some shade that he throws that we have some fun with. But for the most part, he's really good, dude, at dealing with the media and dealing with all of the stuff that comes with it. So I look at it as, hey, man, it's rare that anyone wins the lottery twice, but I've won it twice, and I'm willing to take all the riches that may come with it.
It's not just LeBron. There's so many characters on this team. It is JaVale McGee, Rajon Rondo. We've got Lonzo Ball and LaVar Ball by extension still working around there, et cetera, et cetera. It's definitely going to be an interesting basketball team. Do you think it's a good basketball team? And by that, I mean, is there a reasonable belief that they could reach the conference finals before losing to the Warriors?
I think there's an outside chance that they can be in the conference finals. If they avoid the Warriors in the second round, then I think it's absolutely possible. I don't think there's any question about that, because even though I like Houston, and I think Houston would be absolutely favored in a series against the Lakers, I'm not ruling out LeBron against anyone that's not the Warriors at this point. And I'm also curious to see the growth of this team, particularly those young guys. And will those young guys get that opportunity to grow? Because you're right. If there's anything to be said about the Lakers this season, is they won't be boring, because of the guys you mentioned, Rondo, Beasley, McGee, Stevenson. But as good as those guys could be for just the pure viewing experience and all the drama that could come along with it, I just hope that the Lakers, from a basketball perspective, don't get sucked into, oh, we need to play the veterans, as opposed to taking advantage of harnessing the potential of some of these young guys that they have, like Ingram and Kuzma and Lonzo, et cetera. I think that that's where they should really focus. But I again, LeBron's history says that's not generally going to be the case. He's going to want to surround himself with veterans for the most part. And maybe a couple of these young guys will survive this. But I don't know if that's the right approach. So for me, just from a pure sports basketball perspective, it's fascinating. Having those personalities clearly makes it fascinating. And just the drama that all of that will entail makes it just something that you're going to want to tune into every day if you're someone who is a Laker fan or a basketball fan.
So LeBron got off to a slow start in Miami, as you remember. And then when he returned to Cleveland, they also got off to a slow start. If they get off to a slow start now in Los Angeles, there's really going to be a microscope on them. What chances do you think would you put on it right now in August that they miss the playoffs this season?
Well, I think there's a chance because you always have to factor in injuries, right? I think that that plays a role in all of this and how competitive the West is. And yeah, you're right. They did get off to a poor start in Miami, 9-8 through 17 games. But then they kind of hit their stride, and I believe they won 21 out of the next 22 or something like that. And in Cleveland, they started off actually 19-20, if I recall correctly. So they were basically halfway through that first season where everyone was like, what is happening here? So I think this Lakers team could have a similar start like that. Absolutely. Because you're throwing all these parts together. There's going to be this kind of feeling out period for everyone, not just the players, but for Luke Walton and the coaching staff with Brian Shaw and those guys. Like, who's going to play? Who's going to play when? Who's playing in what combination or what groupings? All those things are going to be important. And I think that they're going to need a month or two to figure all that stuff out, which is why I think that the way the schedule lines up is interesting when they're going to get to play the Warriors. Not that I expect them to beat the Warriors, as I told you earlier, but in the regular season, things can happen, right? Anything can really happen. Hell, we saw the Lakers, a young Lakers team, beat the Warriors in LA before. So I just want to see where they're at for that Christmas game, like where they measure up, because we're 2 months in, and see kind of how that unfolds. But yeah, look, there's a chance they don't make the playoffs. I have them right now somewhere between 48 and 50 wins. If they're closer to 48, there's a real shot that they may be on the outside looking in, because I think that you're going to need at least 48 to get in to the Western Conference playoffs. So there, then you're talking potentially about tiebreakers and all that stuff, and it could get dicey. But even 50, as crazy as that sounds, 50 could be something that'll get you a sixth seed or a fifth seed in the Western Conference.
There was a real sense in Cleveland that LeBron was the shadow GM, and he made some moves that objectively cost his team against the Warriors these last 2 years, in the sense that Tristan Thompson and J.R. Smith might have been overpaid relative to what they were worth, and then they weren't very valuable in big spots. Some of these moves in L.A. seem to have LeBron's fingerprints on them. KCP maybe getting overpaid relative to his market worth, bringing in McGee and Rondo. Does LeBron having personnel input, if not control, concern you as somebody who, as a radio host, is looking for this team to be good?
Yeah, I do think that there is a sense that he, in Cleveland specifically, kind of maybe overplayed his hand, overstepped his bounds a little bit, tried to take on too much, maybe is probably the best way to describe it. And with David Griffin, and I don't know Griff super well, but I know him well enough that LeBron, they'd come to him with stuff and he'd kind of discuss how he felt about it. Now, I think that that collaboration generally tends to happen with all great players in some way, shape, or form, unless you have what LeBron was at or where he was at before, where with Pat Riley, you know, he'll mention, hey, this is what we're thinking, but he's going to do whatever he wants, because Pat Riley is, he's got the guy. Pat Riley is the guy with the biggest you-know-what on the table, basically. He's the guy that's going to show you that this is his team no matter what. It's his way or the highway. And I think with Cleveland, LeBron really wanted to show everyone that he could do it on his own in some ways. And again, that's not to take away from what David did, because David did do a lot of smart deals while he was there. And I think that it just took a minute for LeBron to really kind of realize how good David Griffin was at his job. And then things got a little easier. And if you notice, when Griffin parted ways with the Cavs, that's when things got really bad for Cleveland, because they made these deals for Derrick Rose or whatever. They signed guys like Derrick Rose. They signed all these guys kind of off the scrap heap, basically. They made the deals for Jordan Clarkson and Larry Nance Jr. They gave up a first-round pick for those guys with Kobe Altman, who, look, is a fine young executive, but there's a difference when you're the third guy in charge in the personnel department and you're the first guy in charge. And there's a learning curve there. And clearly they had to learn that learning curve. And by then it was too little too late. But you saw how Griffin would make some really shrewd deals while he was with LeBron, but he had to earn his trust some. The difference with LeBron with the Lakers, and I think he'll have some involvement, and they'll run everything by him, but I think that Magic will have more say than Griffin did and the guys in Cleveland did, is because Magic can relate to LeBron on a different level, Ryan. There are very few people in the world that can sit here and say that they've been in the shoes that LeBron James has worn. And Magic Johnson can say that. He understands what it's like to be the greatest player on the planet and all the pressures that comes with that. So when LeBron met with Magic, that was a meeting of the minds as far as what kind of team they wanted to build. Like, the Laker thing to me was done years ago. The minute they couldn't defend their title against the Warriors and Durant was in Golden State and they lost to those guys, LeBron was already plotting the next move. And look, that's all speculation on my part, but I'm willing to sit there and say that even though I don't know LeBron personally like that, we're not boys by any stretch of the imagination, I've been around him enough to know how strategic he is. I would say LeBron and Shaq are probably the two most strategic guys I've ever been around. Like, everything they say, they know how it's going to come across and how it's going to resonate. And they're always trying to think ahead. But LeBron is 2 and 3 steps ahead, even more so than Shaq was. So as calculated as Shaq was, LeBron takes it to a different level. So I think that's kind of where this thing started. And I think that LeBron really missed some of the structure that he had in Miami. And he tried to bring that structure to Cleveland, but it didn't work exactly the same way. So as much as him and Pat didn't get along at the end, because it's Pat's way or the highway, I think LeBron and Pat both admire each other because they're kind of the same guy. So Magic Johnson, as a disciple of Pat Riley, brings some of that structure that LeBron is used to and craves. And it's going to be an easier relationship for him because this guy gets what it's like to be him. And I know that because it seems just fairly obvious. And the other part of the equation is that when Magic Johnson took that job, he was on my radio show. And I asked him specifically, hey, man, whose brain did you pick before you took this gig? And he said, oh, easy. I spent a week with Pat Riley. And we talked about everything from running the front office to, you know, guys' nutrition and the training and the practices and all that stuff. And right then and there, kind of a light bulb went off, because obviously there was stuff about LeBron to the Lakers at that point. And I'm like, oh, man, this is a match made in heaven, because he gets all the stuff he liked about Miami with an organization that's a glamour organization, and a guy that he can actually relate to. As a basketball player, he can relate to him from a business perspective, because few guys have the business acumen and success that Magic Johnson has, not just in sports, just in general. And obviously LeBron is in that same category. And then, of course, the civic duties. I think all those things lined up perfectly for LeBron and the Lakers. So I think he trusts Magic more so than I think he would trust almost anyone else in that position because of all those things. So it's not an easy answer. The answer was yes. I think that LeBron will have some say, but he'll trust Magic to make the right decisions. Whereas maybe that wasn't the case, at least initially in Cleveland. Certainly was the case in Miami, which is why, part of the reason why he went there alongside to play with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. But yeah, that's your answer. I think that he'll have input, but Magic is making the decisions at the end of the day.
Who is more likely to be a Laker a year from now, Klay Thompson or Kawhi Leonard?
I'm in the minority on this. I think it's Klay Thompson. And I say that because I think he fits better with LeBron. My understanding is that Kawhi isn't necessarily keen on the idea of playing with LeBron. Now, I know we'd heard that. I know that Shams Charania had put that out there when he was having a conversation with Colin Cowherd. It wasn't a report. It was just speculation on his part. But, and I'm not reporting any of this either, but when I was at Summer League, that got a lot of traction. And I talked to a lot of people who felt the same way. So when you hear that stuff, if there's enough smoke there, there's fire. And I do think that the Clippers are a real option for Kawhi. And I don't know if the Lakers are the right fit, because I don't think Kawhi loves all the attention. I think clearly we've seen that. And if he really wants to be in LA, just the fact that the Clippers are there and they're a more low-key organization, they're not going to get the kind of attention the Lakers get by any stretch of the imagination. I actually think that's a better fit for him. And I think he realizes that. And I think his team realizes that. Because even though locally they don't move the meter, nationally, that team, when they were good, when they had Blake and CP3 and DeAndre, nationally, they got a lot of love because they were fun to watch and they were good. But locally, they didn't move the meter. So he won't get all the grief that comes with being a Laker. And I mean that in the sense of having to deal with all the media obligations and the spotlight that's going to be on the Lakers. Even when they're bad, you get that kind of stuff. But certainly when they're good, you're going to get a ton of it. He doesn't have to deal with any of that stuff, because they are, in essence, the redheaded stepchild of Los Angeles basketball. And I think he likes that. And Doc is there and Jerry West. Like, I think all that stuff makes some sense. With Klay, I actually think he fits better alongside LeBron. Klay doesn't care about anything, man. Like, Klay will roll with whatever you want. And whether that's being the second or third guy on the Warriors, the fourth guy, wherever you want to slot him, he just wants the ball, right? He wants to play. He wants to shoot threes. He wants to, you know, defend the best guy. Like, he wants to do all that stuff, and he really doesn't get rattled by anything. He doesn't have an ego in that sense. And I think that Kawhi, we are starting to see, has a much bigger ego than any of us thought. So I do think Klay fits best. And if I were guessing, I would say the Lakers really would prefer to have Klay, because I think they see some of the things that we just discussed here.
Do you think there's something to the idea of Jimmy Butler and Kyrie Irving teaming up on, say, the Knicks or Nets a year from now?
Oh, I think that there's something to that for sure. Look, Jimmy Butler wanted Kyrie to go to Minnesota, and Kyrie had Minnesota on their list. I think all those guys, look back at the list that Kyrie had, and I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but it was the Knicks. The Nets will be a player because they'll have money, and it's still New York. Minnesota at the time, Jimmy doesn't want to be there, so rule them out. I believe San Antonio was on that list, Boston was on that list, and Miami's on that list. San Antonio's cap situation, I don't know it off the top of my head, but I could do a quick look here and see what they look like. Miami is trying to make a bunch of deals right now as we speak to try to run off a bunch of these bad contracts because they want to be a player in 2019. And my colleague Brian Windhorst and I agree on this. We've talked about this. Somebody is going to want to go to Miami again because it's got all the things you'd want as a player. No state income tax, a team that has a championship culture, a top five coach, and an iconic guy running it in Pat Riley. Oh, and it's South Beach, you know, right down the, you know, across the bridge. So you've got all the stuff that makes sense, and you can get players to go play with you there. So I think they're in the mix. I think the two New York teams are heavily in the mix. Those would be the three teams that I think make a ton of sense. And if San Antonio has cap space, I think that they make a ton of sense too.
So you mentioned in the Kawhi section about the Clippers moving the meter. I want I want you to rank in terms of relevance all of the teams in LA. So Lakers are obviously first, but then behind them is, in some order, the Clippers, the Rams, the Chargers, the Dodgers, the Angels, USC football, and UCLA basketball. Can you rank those and then also kind of put them in tiers?
I can. And real quick, San Antonio does not have a ton of cap space. They actually will probably be over the cap, so I would rule them out unless they deal for these guys. So back to those, just real quick on those two, New York teams and Miami, if Miami clears the space, or San Antonio if they clear the space. All right, so ranking the LA teams, Lakers clear number one. I would say in the same tier, but a clear number two are the Dodgers. Hmm. And the strange part about that is 70% of the city can't watch their games because they're in this ridiculous dispute with DirecTV and everyone really outside of Spectrum Cable, which I believe is on my Charter now. It used to be Time Warner. All that stuff. That stuff is also confusing because there's so much consolidation. But it's wild, right? That 70% of the city can't see their games, but yet because of longevity, because of history, because they've been a winning franchise for a lot of this, they are the clear number two. Then after that, it gets interesting, right? The next tier at number three, I would still say USC football, when they're rolling, is pretty big out here. And I saw that recently the last 2 years with Sam Darnold. Like, it was a real thing. And so I would say they're third. Then, the Rams have started to creep up very quickly. Now, they also have a history because, remember, they were in Orange County. They used to play in Anaheim forever.
Yeah.
And so I think they're there. And I think the Clippers and Rams are in kind of a similar – they're in the same tier, but they're the fourth or fifth team. You can flip-flop those two.
I forgot the Kings.
Yeah, look, hockey gets – they have diehards, hockey, but hockey gets no traction on sports talk radio here. And
here with the Blackhawks as Stanley Cup winners, even when that was true, the Bulls could generate more discussion with like the Derrick Rose, Jimmy Butler, Tibbs teams.
Yeah, they get no traction. They're actually on a news station, I believe. I don't know which news station I can find the Kings game on, but it's on some sort of news talk station. And yeah, like they don't register the same way. So Lakers, Dodgers, first tier. But clear one and two, there's a separation there. USC three in the next tier, which is the second tier, followed by Rams, Clippers in that conversation. Then after that, man, there's like a third tier of everyone else, right? Whether that's UCLA basketball, right? I think is in that conversation. I think that
That's Chargers. A big downgrade in the last 20 years for them.
Yeah, for sure. But people still get hyped up. Like when Lonzo was there, people were totally into it. We were actually talking UCLA basketball when Lonzo Ball was there. So, you know, they can find themselves into the conversation. But UCLA basketball is in that third tier. Somewhere in there is the soccer teams. And the Chargers are kind of in that conversation too because the Chargers don't have a fan base in L.A. I mean – you go to bars around LA, there's not a ton of Charger fans. Like, it wasn't the case even when they were in San Diego. So that next tier is, that third tier is kind of everyone else, basically, with maybe UCLA basketball being near the top of that third tier.
And so I wanted to talk to you about the differences between national and regional radio. So you came up through Miami. You did national overnights for Fox Sports Radio. You eventually had a couple different nightly iterations on ESPN Radio and then made the decision to go back to local out in LA. I am of the belief that there is a re-regionalizing in terms of sports talk, maybe not even just on radio, but also on television, as ESPN from, I'd say, 1990 through 2010 gobbled up so much territory, there was more sort of national talk. That wasn't true in New York or LA or Chicago or some of these big cities that are really self-sustaining ecosystems. But now I think in smaller markets, we're starting to see preferences really reveal themselves that people just want to hear about their own teams. What do you think about that?
Oh, that's always going to be the case. I think that national radio always faces that, right? I think that you always have this thing where it's going to be hard to compete in any market against the guy who's talking about the teams that people care about locally. Like, that's always the challenge. And it goes to show you how hard it is to break through, right? Like, you look at shows like Levitard or Colin Cowherd. Like, those guys break through. Now, they're on a ton of markets. Dan Patrick's on a ton of markets. All that stuff. Some of that is just how big those guys are from a personality perspective. They're either polarizing, they're likable, whatever the reason may be, they break through in a certain way, shape, or form. But there are very few of those, right? And the funny thing about LA is that, and I had this conversation once with Ramona Shelburne, my colleague, which is, she said to me, when you're here in LA, you're going to notice more people on the streets are going to recognize you from the radio than they do the television, because our television shows are programmed towards the East Coast. So they don't get to watch the TV shows that you're on. And she's right. A perfect example was yesterday. I was at a car dealership because my lease is coming up, and the sales guy walks up to me. I was there with my wife, and he says, "I know you." And I said, "You know me?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I go, "Where do you know me from?" And he's like, "I listen to your show every morning. You guys are great, blah, blah, blah."
You know what you look like.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so it's just that kind of stuff. And she's right. I get, you know, occasionally there are people that will say, "Oh, you're great on The Jump," or whatever, because they'll DVR it or something like that. But for the most part, you're getting, and The Jump is also on at noon, right? So at least people are out to lunch. Maybe it's on a TV screen. They recognize you from that. But for the most part, here in LA, they recognize you from the radio. And there is that sense that the local stuff matters. And New York, clearly, that's the case. It's rare that a show breaks through on New York radio that's a network radio from a sports perspective. You can be a national political show and make that work, because I think that that's just a different arena, right? So I think that whether you're Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or whoever, I think that you can break through differently when you're talking about stuff that affects the entire country and everyone kind of feels like they have their own say or part to do with whatever the policies are and what they're discussing, right? So with sports, yeah, man, like, no offense, I'm not watching an NFL game that's like the Cleveland Browns, the Cincinnati Bengals. Like, maybe, I know there are people that will watch it, but I'm not interested in that, you know? So, but if you're in Cleveland or in Cincinnati, you want to hear about those teams. So the national radio part of it is tough. I will say this, though. When I was doing the first stint on national radio in my early 20s or mid to early 20s on Fox Sports Radio, the advantage of being on at that time at night, and I was on 2 to 6 a.m. Eastern, was that I was on every station, like every city, basically outside of New York, I was on. I was on in LA, I was on in Chicago, I was on in Detroit, I was on in Boston, and I was on big stations because of that. Because at that time of night, nobody's going local for the most part outside of New York City, where I believe Tony Page might have been the guy who was doing overnight radio on WFAN at that time. So, or Steve Summers. No, Summers, I think, was earlier than that. Yeah. So, either way. So, you know, national radio, for you to break through is hard, or you have to get the clearance, right? If you've got the clearance, it works, like the guys I mentioned earlier. But if you don't have the clearance, man, it really is hard to break through. And I just think that there is an easier connection point when you're doing local in a big market. Like, I work in a market now where there's two of every team in every sport, basically. So you don't sit around wondering, do I have enough content? There's always enough content. Even on a slow day, there's content to work with. So I think that kind of matters too. I also think this market in LA is different in the sense that the demographics are interesting, right? 50% almost of the marketplace is Hispanic, and a good chunk of them are non-English speaking. Miami was almost identical in that sense from a makeup perspective, demographic makeup. And I think because of that, it allowed me to say to myself, all right, when this move to LA was presented to me, can I make this work? And I thought because of the fact that I came from a market that was almost a mirror image, even though it was a smaller market years ago, the demographic makeup allowed for me to understand how to attack the marketplace. And you couple that with the fact that there's not a lack of content because there's so many teams in LA, I thought it was an easy decision for me to make. And it's worked out really well because we've done really well with this move to LA and the radio show.
From an ESPN television perspective, I'm going to borrow a line from Ben Cafardo, who is the ESPN PR point man on the NBA thing, referring to a WWE line from The Miz and Maurice, who call themselves the It Couple. He calls the NBA the It Property. And it, over the last 2 years especially, it's just undeniable how much it's grown in relevance with the conversation picking up. And you've gotten yourself into the mix with that as a sideline reporter, as a little bit in play-by-play in Summer League. How do you go about going to ESPN's decision makers and getting them to give you those types of opportunities?
Well, I knocked on the door for 2 years before I got the shot to do it, that's for sure. And look, I get it. I remember having this conversation with Tim Corrigan, who is the CP on NBA, and you know, he does an unbelievable job. And when I was in Miami, my last couple of years, when I was there, when LeBron was there, I did a ton of TV for Sun Sports, which was owned by Fox Sports. They're one of the regional cable networks, and they have the Heat broadcasts. And they had me doing multiple roles with them. I was initially on as kind of an analyst for their pregame stuff. And then they liked what they saw on the screen. So I remember the year after that, they said, well, you could still do the analyst stuff for the home games, but would you be willing to do the hosting role for the road games? And our guy, Jason Jackson, can kind of concentrate on doing the sidelines and the features and stuff on the road and not have to worry about hosting. I was like, yeah, man, let's do it. So I got a lot of reps doing that. And then I was able to do some sideline type of stuff while they were at home, plus doing the analyst stuff. Look, I was knee deep and entrenched in the NBA. I'm going to be the first one to tell you, I'm sure many people from Miami can attest to this, that I have the roles I have at ESPN because LeBron went to play in Miami. Now, I might have ended up on ESPN anyway because I had built up relationships there prior to, but I think I've gotten the opportunities that I've gotten because of the type of stuff I was able to do in Miami when LeBron was there. And this role that I have with the NBA now has a lot to do with that too, is that I knocked on the door, and at that time, man, the sidelines was deep 2 years ago. It was Lisa Salters, Doris Burke, Chris Broussard, Israel Gutierrez, and I'm missing somebody. Heather Cox. Okay, they were five deep on NBA sideline reporters back then.
Did you say Adande too?
Oh, and Jay Adande. So six deep. Excuse me. You're right. Six deep on sideline reporters. And I remember going up to Tim Corrigan and saying in Bristol and saying, look, man, I can do this. Here's what I've done. And he was familiar with my work. And I said, I know you got a full cupboard, but if someone's out, sick or whatever, you know, feel free to use me. Like, I'm around and I can do it and I want to do it. And he was like, cool, no problem. I brought that up because I remember having this conversation with my buddy Izzy Gutierrez, who had just started doing sidelines at that time, that Chris Broussard missed a game because he had kidney stones or something. And I was like, oh, you know, not that I'm expecting anyone to have kidney stones all the time, but look, that is a good opportunity to say, hey, look, this just happened. If you find yourself in a pinch, I can do it. And honestly, that's kind of the way life works in general in any walk of life. But at ESPN, you kind of have to knock down those doors and try to kind of work your way into those conversations. And eventually it worked. So I spoke to him again the next summer and had a similar conversation. Now, the cupboard wasn't as full anymore because Chris was gone. J.A. was gone. Heather was gone. They added Cassidy into that mix. Doris was doing more analyst stuff. And Corrigan had a very honest conversation with me. And he said, look, man, I like you. I like what you do. We like what you do. And I may use you. I may not use you. I may use you a little. I may use you a lot. I may not use you at all. But I just appreciated him being honest with me about it. And I was like, dude, I got it. If anything comes, I'll be ready. And, you know, that conversation was had last August. Yeah, August of 17. And, you know, long story short, I found myself in Bristol because I had been living in LA already at this point. And I was in Bristol for some meetings. And I got a message from a woman named Sarah Guerrero who works for Tim Corrigan. She's like, hey, do you want to do the game on December 22nd at Houston with the Clippers with Van Gundy and Breen? And I was like, what? Sure. No problem. Super pumped. Met with her there in the CAF in Bristol. And we talked about it. And that was it. That was my first shot. And honestly, I couldn't have asked for a better first shot because the people I worked with were tremendous in Breen and Van Gundy. And, you know, not to mention the staff behind the scenes with Ken Wolf, who produces NBA. And Ken, you know, you can just Google him and you can see the type of stuff that guy's done. He used to produce Monday Night Football on ABC. So that guy's been doing this for a long time. So I got a chance to work with a really good group and they made me look great. So it worked out. It went perfectly as one could possibly go on their first time out doing it. And a lot of it was because Breen was so nurturing and Ken was so nurturing and the entire group was so nurturing. And that led to me doing 5 playoff games. So yeah, I kind of worked my way in there, but it didn't happen overnight. That's for sure. And I don't blame them for it not happening overnight. They've got their guys and girls that they are committed to. So just the fact they would give me anything, I was appreciative of it. And then when they asked me to work summer league, I was like, yeah, man, let's do it. Because I just want as many reps as possible. And I love the NBA. And the one thing I feel like working the shift I work in the morning is that I don't get to as many games as I'd like to because you're gassed from waking up at 4 in the morning every day. And you don't get to as many live events as one would like. And to me, that's part of it. It's just not only being at the live events, but being able to talk to guys, players, coaches, GMs, all those type of people and have them see you face to face. It's different when you get their perspective like that. And then you're able to translate that to the different platforms, whether it was on radio or when I used to host the NBA podcast for ESPN or when I'm on The Jump or any of those things. Yeah, I just think that it really enhanced what I was doing in the other places. And it's just something I love, right? I love being around the NBA. So you're right. It is the it property. And I'm just glad to have any role with the it property right now.
One of the stations you came up through was the fabled 790 The Ticket. And this lineup featured yourself. It featured the early local incarnation of the Dan Le Batard show with Stugatz. Boog Ciambi had a show there. The guy running the station was a person who was a young man who had inherited a lot of money and was spending it freely. Can you tell me some wild stories about what that workplace was like?
I can tell you some. I don't want to give them all away because the last time I did the Le Batard show, I was just in Miami this past weekend for Dan's charity event called Mas Miami. And I sat in on their local hour and we sounded like a bunch of old fuddy-duddies just sitting there reminiscing about the old days. But we were talking about just kind of that time, what a crazy time it was. That station, man, like, I don't even know how we were on the air at times because it was so dysfunctional. And I say that in the most loving way possible. I mean, there were times literally I wondered if we were going to get paid, let alone, have like an actual job and career. And remember, I left a network gig at Fox to take that job back in my hometown, but I really did believe in what they were doing. I would guess some of the wild stories, the owner rented the Versace mansion. And the Versace mansion, have you seen the story of Johnny Versace on FX or anything like that? Are you familiar with that story? Okay. So Johnny Versace, obviously the designer, used to have a home on South Beach. And it's literally on Ocean Drive. So when I tell you, if you walk out the door, across the street is the sand. And, you know, on Ocean Drive on South Beach, it's mostly a bunch of hotels or retail stores, things like that. Maybe a couple of apartment complexes, things of that sort. But there was nothing like this. Like, it was the only house that's on that street that stretches 15 blocks. So this thing is humongous. And they rented it out for, I believe, close to $2 million for a week to have a Super Bowl party there. And, you know, I mean, you listen to sports radio. You've been to sports radio events. Sports radio events are typically done at some local pub with like 15 chronics showing up asking you the same questions. These parties were South Beach parties with red velvet ropes and really famous people showing up all the time. And Dan and Stu Gotch, I remember, were doing a red carpet during the Super Bowl party. That obviously the Super Bowl was in Miami that year. And the party on the invitation, I think, started at 10. But, you know, it's Miami. Nothing really starts at 10. Everything is like midnight and later. And it's 10 o'clock. Dan and Stu Gotch are doing a live radio show outside on the red carpet. And, you know, people from the station are showing up early because they want to make sure to show support, et cetera, et cetera. And the first athlete to show up right at 10 on the dot was Eli Manning. And I remember Dan going to him, "Eli, what are you doing here so early?" And he goes, "What do you mean? The party starts at 10. He goes, "Clearly you've never been to Miami before." So this party had 100 athletes. It was the craziest Super Bowl party I've ever been to. Think of the craziest company Super Bowl party you've been to. ESPN.
This sounds like a pre-2008-2009 economy crash party.
Right, for sure. I mean, this is like 2004, I think, or something. Yeah, that
life was different than in a lot of industries, sports media included.
No doubt. So, yeah, I mean, so all of a sudden, this party's raging till 5 in the morning, and there's just athletes everywhere. Scantily clad women everywhere, drinks flowing everywhere, celebrities like Ludacris coming out and hanging out at the party. It was the best Super Bowl party I've ever been to in my life, bar none. No disrespect to Michelle Beadle, who throws a great Super Bowl party, or any of the companies like ESPN or Jay Glazer, who's thrown a party for years. Like, this topped it all, and I've never seen anything like it since, because it had kind of that crazy South Beach flair of just excess everywhere. And radio station, a local radio station on AM, not an FM station, not like the top 40 station or the top hip hop station throwing this crazy concert bash. No. This was an AM radio station throwing this crazy bash. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. I was just telling someone about Dan's charity event recently. That's as crazy, and I mean that in a great way, like as cool an event as I've ever seen, and it's basically backed locally by an AM radio station. The power that those guys have and had was pretty evident right away. But when you had the gentleman who was running the station at the time, Joel Feinberg, and all that financial backing, and Stu Gotts frivolously spending all his money, we felt like we couldn't be stopped. But Ryan, the crazy part about all of that is, you know, that station, we were going up against a monster. It was like a small mom and pop station going after WFAN. And we eventually won. And we were mocked and ridiculed. Specifically, Dan's show was mocked and ridiculed, called Sissy Boy Radio. right? They don't talk enough sports. They don't, they can't measure from a credibility perspective. All we were a bunch of 20-something and 30-something-year-old guys just making fun of the establishment. And I know there's a lot of that now where, you know, you have the Barstools and those guys. But, you know, and, you know, Deadspin, obviously, at the time. Like, we were those guys first, I feel like. And really, Dan was the impetus for all of that.
He was a Pied Piper for it, it seems like.
He was. I would not have left a network gig, a cushy network gig, the first six-figure gig of my life, okay, at 20-something years old, had Dan not been there. I would have never left that gig had Dan not been involved with that.
This is a little bit of a stark transition to make, but it stuck out to me maybe a year ago, you wrote a piece on how Dwayne Wade really connected you with your father. And so I wanted you to explain that story to people who may not have read it, but are listening now.
Okay. If people do want to read it and they're listening to this, it's pinned on my Twitter at Sedano ESPN, Sedano ESPN. Long story short, you know, I grew up with a emotionally repressed old Cuban father, right? And I think a lot of men are emotionally repressed, right? I was joking when I was watching the two Bills 30 for 30 with Boog Shambi about that's like the perfect phrase to describe those guys. And my dad was kind of like that, right? So we didn't really ever communicate very well when I was a kid, except when we were watching sports together. That's when all the weird awkwardness of growing up went away, and it was just me and him focused on what was going on the television. And it started at a very young age, like most kids, right? My dad's a big Yankee fan. I grew up in Florida. There was no Marlins at the time, so we used to get the Yankees, Mets, and Braves games in Miami at that time. And my dad grew up a Yankee fan, so I was born in New York. So we watched baseball together. And over the years, you know, it grew into football. I remember being a seven-year-old kid. You know, the Dolphins were in the Super Bowl, and we'd watch Dolphins games together for years. And then we started watching basketball together. My dad was not a basketball fan because, even though he's a big sports fan, because Cuban people, you know, on the island, they love baseball, they love boxing. My dad was able to grow to love American football. And because, you know, Don Shula, Dan Marino, right? Like, who wouldn't love watching that, you know, in their heyday? And my dad was actually able to watch kind of the undefeated team and those type of guys. So he was, when he first came to the country, that's what he was able to watch. That's how he got into American football, because the Dolphins had just gotten Don Shula in, I believe, 69 or 70, and, you know, took off from there. So when I was a kid, I got him to watch basketball. Because the first experiences I had with basketball were the Lakers-Celtics rivalry. And again, it's greatness. Like, who doesn't want to watch greatness? Especially if you're a sports fan. So I kind of got my dad into basketball. Then the Heat got a team in the late 80s. We started watching the Heat. It wasn't pretty because they were bad for a long time. And I remember when the Heat drafted Dwayne Wade, my dad and I were like, wow, this is cool. Like, you know, like they feel like they're gonna have this cool young team. They had Lamar Odom and Caron Butler. Like, we were super excited. So then shortly thereafter, that was also the same year the Marlins went to the World Series and beat the Yankees. And I was out there on assignment covering that World Series. And so shortly after my return from the World Series from New York, my dad had a massive stroke. And I found out literally, you know, within hours of me landing in Miami. And that kind of changed our relationship, right? Beyond just sports, where we kind of became a lot closer. And my dad lost the ability to speak. He could communicate through writing things down and things of that sort, but he lost his ability to speak, and he was partially paralyzed from his right side. And this is the person I grew up, you know, thinking was the strongest person in the world, right, as a kid. And here he is in this most vulnerable situation. So I found myself, as time grew by, you know, spending more time with him because, you know, look, you really just, it kind of snaps you into this kind of, it snaps you out of this like fantasy land that you're living in, right, where you think everything is great, into reality where you're like, oh crap, you know, life is real and it can be gone in a second. Because my dad almost died. Like, it was very touch and go. So I spent a lot more time with him after that. And, you know, that was Dwayne's rookie year. And the team overachieved. And we had a blast watching games. And I used to live very close to my parents back then, like maybe a couple of miles away. So I would come every night and have dinner at my parents' house. And we'd watch games. And, you know, we really got to be like Dwayne Wade was our guy. And over the years, that stuff really kind of held our relationship together because it kind of gave my dad some time to really focus on sports and how much he loved sports, how much time we could spend together and how much time we loved spending together or spending it together. And it gave him less of an opportunity to think about his current state, right? How he was kind of trapped in his own body where he could think perfectly. My dad would read the newspaper in English and Spanish every day and totally comprehend what he's reading, totally could understand what you were saying, but couldn't speak. You know, like he literally would say, you know, the words were like a baby talking to you, like no, yes, like it was hard, right? So you'd have to jot things down. It was really a difficult time, or you'd play charades, basically. But I think that those moments really kept us going in the sense of it really brought us together and really made us kind of not worry about the other stuff. So Dwayne brought us together in a lot of ways. And I remember having this conversation actually with Dwayne about this. And then I wrote the story when Dwayne left that summer to Chicago because I really thought about it, like, wow, you know, like, even though I wasn't watching the games as regularly with my dad because I was living in Connecticut, but, you know, we'd FaceTime and stuff, and I'd call and talk to my mom and all that. But I knew my dad was watching the games, and I knew my dad was super bummed about Dwayne leaving Miami. So I wrote that story about how Dwayne Wade brought us together and how we were there with him the whole time and in the hot during the highs and the lows and, you know, the championship in 06 and the subsequent championships after that. The championship in 06 was funny. There's a story in there, in that story I wrote, about how my mom told me that when they were down against Dallas, my dad would get pissed off and just turn off the TV. And my mom would get mad. She'd be like, what the hell? I want to see how it ends. And he'd just be like, no, I'm done with it. And so they were down in game three. They were down 0-2 in the series, back in Miami now. And they were down, I believe, 13 points with 6.5 minutes left to go. And my dad turned off the television. And that's one of the single greatest comebacks in NBA Finals history, where Dwayne Wade carried them to that win, and they ended up winning the series. And I remember calling my mom after the game and saying, oh my God, did you guys just see that? And my mom's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, they won the game. And she's like, get the bleep out of here. And she's like yelling at my dad, they won the game. And I can hear my dad just kind of screaming in the background laughing. And that from that point on, clearly they didn't turn the games off anymore. Though my dad would screw with my mom by like acting like he was going to turn the game off if it was out of control. Or they would take like a double digit lead and then he'd just laugh at her and whatever. But yeah, man, like he brought us together. And, you know, Dwayne sent me a message after he saw the story. And because it published that day and I was going to see him that day because I was there covering the game for SportsCenter. And he sent me a message like, man, that was crazy. He's like, I'd really love to meet your dad. And I'm like, yeah, man, sure. We'll try to make that happen. I know your schedule's busy or whatever. So I'm sorry, I'm getting a little emotional here. But so long story short, Dwayne loved the piece. And then, you know, Dwayne sent out a message to me one summer about like, hey man, I'll probably be in South Florida for a little bit. Would be cool to get together. And then I was like, yeah, man, here's the problem. My dad's basically in hospice already. And, you know, he wasn't in town or whatever, so it couldn't work. And then my dad passed away. But when my dad passed away, Dwayne sent me a really nice message, which was really nice. You know, like you in sports, it's kind of weird, right? Like we spend all this time discussing these guys, but you kind of forget that they're human too. And they get that we're just doing a job, right? Like most of the guys who've been doing this for a long time get we're doing a job, you know, as long as you're not personal or malicious. But yeah, like it's just like, you know, it just proves the point, right? That why my dad loved Dwayne Wade so much and why we gravitated to him so much is because we just loved him not only as a player, but clearly as a person, right? And that kind of he just kind of reciprocated that when all that went down. And you know, he's still the athlete that I've enjoyed covering the most. When he returned back to Miami, I got the chance to interview him on SportsCenter when he came back, and it was just great. Like he's kind of my guy. You know, I know that we're not supposed to be in the tank for anyone. But I've always said I'm going to be in the tank for Dwayne Wade. Like that's just the reality of it. So you may not get 100%.
Everybody's in the tank for at least somebody.
Yeah, you may not get 100% objectivity from me on Dwayne Wade. Like to me, he's always going to be the guy, right? But yeah. Like so that's what that story's about. And then when my dad passed, I posted the story again. But it's always going to be pinned on my Twitter. It's kind of a cool story. And Henry Abbott, who was an editor at ESPN, True Hoop at the time, really helped me. Because it was a hard thing to write, Ryan. Like that, there's a lot of emotional scars there that I had to put on my computer screen, and it was hard to kind of even just visualize seeing the words, let alone mustering them to write on the computer. You know, you're talking about a near-death experience with your dad and how it's changed your entire life, right? Like this relationship with your dad has changed because of this kind of seminal moment. But also kind of focusing on the good stuff and how Dwayne Wade brought out a lot of that good stuff.
Yeah, no, that definitely, and I was glad that you wrote it because we watch all these sports because we hope that it makes us feel something. And so that definitely did for you and everybody who read that story.
Yeah, that was the goal, man. Like, look, like I said, it's pinned. So occasionally I'll still get a tweet from someone and be like, yo, man, like, thank you for writing this. It really makes me feel like it reminds me of me and my dad or, you know, or me and my mom or whoever, like whoever they loved watching sports with. And yeah, look, man, that was just kind of it. I don't write very often. I think I've written a handful of times at ESPN. They've given me the opportunity to kind of write passion pieces whenever I want. And there's never going to be a bigger passion piece than that one that I wrote that day.
So we're pushing up on an hour, which is pretty long for me, but I think I really appreciated it, and it was good that we went long. Thank you so much for coming on. I really, again, appreciate your time. I know you're busy between the 45 different jobs that we met throughout this piece. So thank you again, and definitely hope to do it again when the Lakers season heats up.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. Whenever you want, I'm available for you, man. Thank you for having me on. I know you've had a ton of people on. You've had all the heavy hitters on, like SVP and a bunch of those guys. So I'm glad I was able to make the rotation. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks again, George.
You got it.
Such turned stranger.